Before you listen to this episode of Gareth Jones on Speed, can I suggest that you either go to the website canoe.com or go to the web page for this edition of the podcast, where there are lots of pictures of the vehicle that we're talking about in this show. I have to tell you, you're about to hear an interview with one of the most intriguing people I've ever spoken to working in the motor industry. Hello, welcome to Gareth Jones on Speed, episode 490. And yes, this is the third episode that I've published in 3 weeks. So we're spoiling you, but you're good to us. So thank you very much for subscribing, downloading and listening and sharing, of course. As you probably have already heard, I've mentioned it on the show before, I've just spent the last week working at the NEC in Birmingham at the Commercial Vehicle Show. Trucks and lorries, road haulage. And that industry is in a period of transition at the moment, as we are in the car industry, shifting from internal combustion engines to alternative fuels and EVs. There were some superb solutions on display at the NEC, but by far the most intriguing vehicle at the show was from a Texas startup called Canoe. It looks like no other. And when I interviewed the CEO of the company, Tony Aquila, I began to understand why this car looked so unusual. It is the result of some very original thinking. Having interviewed Tony for the show, and if you want to see that, I'll give you a link to that where you can see it on YouTube or on the CV Show's website. I'll give you that later on. But when I interviewed Tony, I began to understand why that car was so unusual. He is a very interesting guy who comes to this industry in a very different way. So I thought I just had to have a long, in-depth conversation with Tony about the Canoe range of vehicles. You'll enjoy this. Tony, thank you for finding time to talk to me on Gareth Jones on Speed. How has the CV show been for you?
Gareth, it's been actually a very good show. Tons of traffic, very concentrated, interested parties that we're able to spend a lot of time with to kind of go into the details. So it's been good.
Well, let's get into the details about Canoe. First of all, let's start with the vehicle. It doesn't look like anything else. It looks like it may have been designed by Playmobil or, a space colony somewhere. Right. Was that the mission statement, to make something that is so unique looking? Does that help?
Well, the mission, you know, like all evolutions and companies, they change a bit. And in the beginning, there was a coolness to thing. First of all, we're very infatuated with circles. Your eyes are round for a reason. Cars are square. For what reason? You know, if I take an orange, I throw it in the air, it'll land, it'll absorb, and it'll roll. I take a square in the air, it will not roll. So you think about things. Our view was the typical automotive industry boxes itself. It's like two boxers, and they're fighting, you know, and they're just slugging it out. Whereas we kind of said, we want to be much more like jiu-jitsu. And we really want to be able to take the movement of the person and utilize that movement in a way that would be similar to what you would do in a gymnasium. So by doing that, you keep the body safe. So everybody in the industry has kind of thought of things as TCO. We thought of it as TCPO because the driver's satisfaction.
Hang on, I don't know what TCO and TCPO is.
Yeah, so total cost of ownership.
Oh, right.
Which is really about, don't fool yourself, it's about the OEM's cost to cover warranty effectively. And that's fair and all because they sell it for a certain price. They have to underwrite the percentage of risk. But TCPO means we calculate the things outside of our control, like the driver cost, the driver satisfaction, the driver retention rates, the driver injury rates.
And how does that manifest in the vehicle then?
So that's part of its whole design, is to reduce accident frequency, reduce service maintenance repair, by having long life cycles. So we spend money in very particular areas for the highest quality. And that happens to be around safety. Now, in order to make this design, we had to patent a lot of things. We had to create a lot of IP because vehicles follow the box.
Yeah.
And we did not. So we actually changed that logic system. And in addition to that, we democratized it so that in the future, why should you buy a new chassis? You build a new house, you remodel your house, but you don't buy new land.
Mm-hmm.
You don't rebuy your land.
So explain how that works with a canoe vehicle. You buy a platform.
Correct.
And then you can update the bodywork every few years?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you make that possible?
We can go from the 130 to the Bulldog. We can go all the way to the 190. So think of it this way. If you have a suit, a nice suit, and you get a hole in the coat, you have to buy a new suit. We're much more like jeans in a sports jacket.
Uh-huh.
You get a hole in one, it just looks better, right? you actually just buy one item. So we really thinking that a fleet owner's cost of capital should go down, not up.
Yeah.
And more importantly, where their cost of capital should go down is in their driver satisfaction and in their worker productivity, which brings you to TCPO.
Right.
It's the total cost of professional ownership.
So, a typical case might be, I don't know, an unmarried young person who buys a canoe and goes with the Bulldog, the pickup version.
Yeah.
You know, they have their lifestyle period where they go skateboarding, they go surfboarding, whatever. And then maybe
start a business.
Start a business, give you back the bodywork that you had before, and you put on a van bodywork.
Yeah. You know, you basically spend half the money or less, and you're able to go from your truck. We'll take it back, and we'll refurbish it, and we'll sell it with a new MPP1. So
the MPP1 is the platform.
It's a regenerative model.
Yeah.
So, you know, because, look, even though moisture, in our view, because you salt the roads and things like that here, you have more corrosion risk in the UK than you do in just about anywhere in the world. And we study all that stuff, which is why we do things a special way in the way we coat the frames, the chassis. But if you don't address those issues, and even if you go anywhere in the UK, you'll still go to a wrecking yard and you'll still find rotting steel at the salvage yard.
Uh-huh.
And this is the toughest environment. So what happens, though, is the body, where the rot becomes a problem, is around the wheel well areas, the rocker panels, the areas like that, where our vehicle is coated differently, so it's got 3 times the coverage so that we can go the distance and take the road chips and things like that and have the MAR resistance. But at the end of the day, you want to be able to reuse that MPP1, that multi-purpose platform, and now you want to change with your life. You want to go from your private life to your professional life, maybe back again.
Yeah.
And so we had to figure out how to make everything modular and democratized so that you can upgrade it. Like, for example, if you need a new infotainment system, why do you buy a new car? As you saw with us, you don't need to. We just want to sell you. It's a very different revenue model for us.
Yeah.
We want to make money with the company. We don't want to make money by just selling to the company.
And you're talking about retention here as well.
You
will create a relationship with a customer that's going to last longer than, you know, a more disposable vehicle, you might say.
Yeah.
This is, by definition, a more green approach to automotive.
It's regenerative, right?
Yeah.
We're thinking about, like, even our batteries are recyclable. Our technology is very unique. And if you look at where the body lines are, where your accident frequency is, you have the smallest panel to repair.
It's just
being considerate to the bottom line. This design is thinking of the business owner's return on capital.
We talked about the concept, if you like. Tell me about the technology, the platform itself, motors, batteries, drive system. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so it's our own IP. Otherwise, you have to buy kind of known IP from tier ones. we didn't like what they had at the time, and so we chose to go our own, primarily because we wanted to recycle energy better. We also wanted to move air differently, and we wanted to have a democratized power grid. And that's for many reasons. But
what do you mean by democratized power grid?
Meaning that there are many power grids inside this vehicle. Each one of them can function by themselves, which makes it very slingshot. And just the way we designed it, so another way to think about it is, if I took a 100-pound backpack and I stuck it on your back, for sure you can carry it. But if I took a 100-pound backpack and I slung it on your front of your body, you couldn't carry it. Your body's not designed for it. And so you'll see that this design is designed for the weight it carries.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It doesn't matter where it is within it, it can carry it. So it's like your back. I can throw a bunch of stuff on your back and you can carry it. But I put it on your stomach, you'll hurt yourself.
Tell me about the platform. It's an EV, obviously.
It's all EV.
You've got two or three different battery capacities. Tell me what they are and the drive system.
So we have many configurations of the battery system. It depends on whether it's vehicle or vehicle-assisted activity and power. And so you can go from 80 to 140 kilowatts. But you can also go down to 40. You can go down in other increments. You can go up. You can democratize, meaning leaving power behind. So it's very, very different. As you can tell, people look at it and they're intrigued, but they actually fall in love with it from the inside.
Yeah, yeah. I've been inside. It's not like being in any other vehicle. I mean, it's the very definition of cab forward.
Yeah.
You could not have what you call the windshield, what we call the windscreen, any further forward.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally at the front end of the vehicle.
Yeah. Well, it's part of its integrity. The batteries play a role in integrity. So it's not a box in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we love honeycombs and spider webs. They're the most incredible weight-bearing things you can find, as well as they can adapt to wild parts of nature. So the vehicle is designed to be able to endure a lot. That's why we sold it to the military and others.
Well, tell me about the military connection. What are you doing, for whom, and what's the take-up?
What's known is we've worked with the innovation unit of the Department of Defense. The environment of protecting our children, you know, our sons and daughters, and our soldiers in uniform, you know, they've been using World War II technology, just more armor. Our more armor is harder to move. We have our injury rates are very high moving fuel. And power should be no different than food or ammo. It should be able to be flown in and flown out. And so we do very unique projects. Obviously, we can't discuss, but we provided a special vehicle for the Scout Division, and we're involved in some other areas as well.
I'm reminded of the story of the Mini Moke. I don't know if you know about the Mini Moke. You do. Yeah, a lightweight vehicle, had its origins in defense, that became a leisure vehicle.
Yeah, that's right.
Similar things happening
here.
Well,
we're going the other way. So our belief is if you can build it for soldiers and fleets. See, today, if you study the curve, people go from consumer to industry and to military. But what they're doing is they're just old-fashioned armoring up. The problem is that drives the efficiency down.
Yeah.
What we did is we had to figure out lightweight materials that could absorb massive amounts of inertia. And
so what's the vehicle made of?
It depends on the area, but we use different substrates. We use from composites to high-strength, low-alloy, special design. It's about the way you form it to be able to do it. We've got very interesting patented absorption technology and for collisions. You saw the videos, I think.
Yeah.
It's amazing what a punch this thing can take and how it won't roll over. You know, we just thought about a lot of things, but we also thought about when you're on a mission or you're deploying to a customer's house to do a service, you need to be able to respect their yard. You need to respect their road. You need to be able to turn quickly. You know, you need to do things that common vehicle just can't do. And it's because of its design. It's nothing against anyone. So we wanted to be able to not have a 2-point turn or 3-point turn. We wanted to be able to turn. And when you drive it, you'll see it's incredible and what it can do. on a performance basis.
It's got a long wheelbase, but absolute minimum overhang.
That's correct. You don't want to waste that overhang. That creates yaw. So, you know, it's like aircraft, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to understand the yaw factors. And fleet, the people don't realize they've got goods in there, which is causing yaw. So the way she's stable and anchored is very different. Like, you know, I think you know some people that drove it already, and their commentary is, wow, this is different. It's fully drive-by-wire. It's brake-by-wire. It's minimal a number of parts so that it's easy for maintenance. And over approximately 86% of all repairs are over the air.
You're updating software and abilities. And
tuning. Sometimes we're just tuning for the use case.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Maybe we need to release horsepower. Maybe we need to increase horsepower. The vehicle has an incredibly intelligent platform. We are more a TEM than we are an OEM.
I keep hearing you describing what I would call as a modular approach.
Yes, it's very modular.
Which, in my mind, is completely cogent with NASA's approach.
Yes, we learned a lot from them.
Explain the link with NASA, because this is the official Artemis astronaut van. This is the vehicle that transports astronauts to the SLS. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. So we are the official vehicle for the first 8 miles of every launch for the Artemis program, which has to carry the astronauts, of which nothing can stumble and snag is like disaster, like could cost hundreds of millions to $1 billion. So nothing can go wrong. And during that 8 miles, there's a lot of testing that has to occur. So you need an intelligent platform to do that. You need efficiency of space and access, getting back to the judo versus the boxing. And so we were able to go to them and learned a lot about ergonomics from them and about safety in the way they have to transport this precious cargo. Because one astronaut gets a nick on that uniform, mission scrub.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's
all soft curves on the inside. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's the ingress, egress. Your body moves very little, even though it's on that size of a wheelbase.
Would you describe yourself and Canoe as a disruptor?
I would say we are a radicalist more than we are a disruptor.
What's the difference?
Because a radicalist in business and in fleet is somebody who is willing to go against. A disruptor will change 20%. A radicalist will actually challenge it from a completely different angle, like being a TEM versus an OEM. Like technology, giving the customer access, democratizing the sale process so that you can buy a top hat and not have to buy a chassis. So we are a bit more radical, but our principles are based on the customer.
In an age where the vast majority of EVs on the planet, the new EVs, are coming from China, you're very proud of your approach, which is to make it in the United States of America and what you call allied countries.
Yeah, that's right.
Why do you do that?
Because we're in an unfortunate period globally, because anytime big tech evolutions occur, the big powers will have issues with each other. It's like two OEMs trying to do a joint venture. It's very difficult. And so what we did was, is we realized that we wanted our own IP, otherwise we'll end up looking like everybody else in here.
Yeah, yeah.
And in order to do that, we had to get away from Chinese products because they control everything today that sees, hears, and senses in a car. Which, by the way, with adaptive steering, is quite a dangerous proposition from a national perspective.
Actually, we haven't talked about that, but you don't have a steering wheel, you have essentially a yoke.
Yeah, that's right.
And that means that means that at low speeds, large movements result in small steering change, but at higher speeds, large movements of the steering wheel or the yoke give you a lesser rate of steering change. Is that right?
So for military use cases, adrenaline driving can cause overreaction.
Mm.
So the vehicle is designed to behave to kind of keep your adrenaline rushes in order. So it's much like a fighter jet.
Yeah.
And how it tightens and loosens. And that is very important because fleet people are busy, they're fatigued, they're getting in and out. They got to move quick. They got to adapt quickly. That's why the vehicle does what it does, is so that their situational awareness is very turned on. And if you look at a lot of these vehicles, it's thinking of cost to sell rather than what it takes to make money and keep the business running. They're just different, right? Different angles of attack. But to defend your data is something that will become more real to every business.
So all the tech on board, including the microprocessors, are all U.S. built or U.S. allied built, right?
Yes, we are U.S. and allied nation, and the core components are core allied nations. So people, we will endure the greatest of pains together if it happens individually, of which we both, you know our ancestors have performed before. The thing everybody needs to understand is EV is not just about the ecological issue. It's a sovereignty and a national defense issue as well.
Interesting. I've got to talk about the business model.
Yeah.
Because there are any number of startups who have great ideas and they fail to get over that initial hump. Now, you are a remarkably successful businessman with a long history of great success in multi-billion dollar industries. Why, in that case, did you decide to get into motor vehicles? That's a risky one, isn't it?
Well, in my former life, all OEMs bought my technology that I sold them. And we had a thesis that the market was going to change and that we are in a new evolution. You know, look, from my perspective, the steering column belongs in the Smithsonian Institute.
Yeah.
But you look at a jet that flies by wire, how it can react, its service maintenance repair, its agility in combat, its ability to adapt to an adrenaline rush and bring those things to stability and effectiveness. You know, and that's what we did here, because that risk factor is actually higher on the road than it is in the air.
Oh, yeah, of course. You're far more likely to hit something on the road than
that's
you
right.
are. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. You got to worry about everybody is a bogey.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so, you know, making sure that these drivers have that situational awareness. At the same time, when they stop somewhere, you got to protect that data.
Right.
You don't want that data leaving. And so it's just going to be a very interesting period in the way technology is used. And we don't buy it from someone else, we build it.
The pilot version, if you like, of the canoe that I've seen so far seems to be central steering. Is that right? From looking at the images, if I understand that right? But the vehicles that you've got here are right-hand drive.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, so you saw the video, I think, of the MPP1 running by itself. You can put the steering wheel anywhere. It's drive-by-wire. We don't really care.
So there's no mechanical connection between the steering, the braking, the acceleration, and the platform itself.
No.
It's all cable wireless, right?
Which reduces a lot of factors of service, maintenance, repair. You know, then you get into the way you weld, the type of weld. You know, you asked, why did I do this versus everything else I've done? I think at this point in my life, it was more about somebody has to look at for us to be able to reduce the cost of capital for fleets, not increase it. Because we all want goods brought to us faster and at a better price.
Coming back to the right-hand drive thing, that's something to do with the U.S. Postal Service? Explain that for me.
That's correct, yeah. So the right-hand drive markets are underserved, as we know from our former lives. And, of course, it has a huge engineering effect, which is why they get underserved for some of the OEMs. But for us, we don't care. We can put the steering wheel in the center.
Yeah.
And before we came to the UK, because we have a certain set of criteria in order for us to launch in the market, to meet those. But we went ahead and got with the U.S. Post Office, got their team to approve us, purchase our vehicles. We start delivering mail in May. We've been through their test cycle, through all their groups. And it's a pretty exciting proposition because most postal services are also your largest veteran workforces in your country.
All right. Back to the military link again.
Yeah.
And also in the States, a U.S. postal van is right-hand drive, so they can park on the curb, get out, and suddenly you've got a vehicle that's legal for roads in the U.K. and Japan and any other right-hand drive market.
Yeah, so we kind of think of the Silk Roads and the Roman Roads. We don't think American roads, because roads were long in place before America was ever even thought of. And so you got to think of Roman roads and Silk Roads, if you will. If you can turn in those environments and function on those crown levels and have a very level driving vehicle, you've got a very competitive proposition.
Now, I know that your previous business interests have had a presence here in the UK.
Still do, yeah.
And I came to your stand, and here's an American-built vehicle with the Union flag flown proudly on the door of every single one.
Yeah, that's because every business we do build, we build with our core allied partners. So we actually set up operations, but we do it in a manner in which it's very financially disciplined. So we are bringing some of the work into the country to be able to denominate in that local currency, because you have to sell in their currency.
Yeah, it's got to be right for where it's going to function.
Correct.
It's a really adaptable vehicle. I'm looking at vans, I'm looking at pickups. You can do what we call an MPV, a minivan, a people mover.
That wheelbase will fit 80% of the use cases out there. So we can put a sports car on it. We can do all kinds of things. But right now, what we're very fixated on is getting this technology, because the people who drive the most miles per day generally have the oldest generation vehicles, which means their cost per mile is greater than yours. So we always tell everybody, you know, we admire Elon. He's been very motivational for us and all the innovators. But in reality, some people build EVs for people that don't wear socks. We build them for people who proudly put them on.
Tony, thank you so much for talking so eloquently and so intriguingly about a car that I am utterly fascinated by, and I know On Speed listeners will be too. Good luck with Canoe.
Thank you.
I look forward to driving one myself at some point.
Okay, we'll be back soon, and you know, we'll have a test track, and I would say drive it like you stole it.
Gareth Jones On Speed.
Well, the Canoe stole my heart. I would love to drive one like I stole it. Well, that was an intriguing interview, and I bet you were hearing stuff that you've never heard before. I love talking to him. Just to let you know where Canoe are at the moment, they've got an agreement, as you heard, to deliver vehicles that the US Postal Service will use. They are the crew transportation vehicles, which gets the astronauts from the suit-up room to the base of Launch Pad 39, where they will launch the SLS Artemis missions to the moon. They also have a deal with Walmart to deliver 4,500 delivery vehicle. The range, it's the LDV-190 that has huge cargo space and a big battery pack. The LDV-130 is smaller for last mile and inner city use. The LV, which is aimed at what they say are city explorers, families and adventurers. I would call that an MPV with carriage doors at the rear. And the pickup, known as the Bulldog, I believe now. Grief, that thing looks superb. And the MPDV, the multi-purpose delivery vehicle. When you sit in the cab of a Canoe, it has a glass panel at the front, in between where the headlights are, where your feet are, so you can see pedestrians, children, low-level things. It's a great urban vehicle. And I wish Canoe well. Their future, like any startup, is never guaranteed. I know there's been investment in the company, and I do hope that it continues and we see Canoes in the market here in the UK or wherever you are. If you want to know more about Canoe, go to their website, canoe.com. And if you want to know more about the commercial vehicle show, and you want to see the videos that I recorded there, go to the cvshow.com or to the commercial vehicle show's YouTube channel or their Instagram or Twitter, and you'll see lots of videos of me interviewing people, not just from Canoe, but from all aspects in the world of commercial vehicles at the Commercial Vehicle Show 2024. That's it for Gareth Jones On Speed for the moment. We're going to take a 2-week break. Well, our usual gap. We'll see you in a fortnight with the full crew for more of the same. See ya!
If you enjoyed the show, then please like and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor the podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Wizbang.